Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey guys, Ryan Sprague here. As you all know, the Somewhere in the Skies podcast is always free to consume, but it isn't free to create. That's why I've started the Somewhere in the Skies Patreon campaign. On a monthly basis, you give what you think the show is worth. You'll be helping the show continue, grow, and to be something truly communal. And remember, there are rewards for each level of contribution, and the list is only growing. So please, help Somewhere in the Skies now by becoming a patron. To contribute and to learn more, visit www.patreon.com/somewhereskies. Thank you for your support. And now, on with the show.
This is Somewhere in the Skies with Ryan Sprague.
UFOs are often seen moving silently in the dead of night, piercing through darkness, attempting to tell us something. What that something may be remains elusive. But there are those rare times when directly before or after a UFO event, something just as elusive can often make its presence known. The owl is a creature unlike any other. It symbolizes many things for many people. Wisdom, intuition, light, dark, life, and even death. It is a totem that allows the individual to see what is usually hidden. Could these enigmatic creatures be one of many keys to unlocking the UFO mystery? Could their almost synchronistic presence hold much more relevance than once thought? Today, we speak to Mike Clellan, author of The Messengers, Owls, Synchronicity, and the UFO Abductee. Mike has compiled hundreds of accounts from across the world, ranging from UFO sightings, contact and abduction experiences, and everything in between. He's written extensively about this topic, amongst many others, on his blog, Hidden Experience. We talk today about those experiences, and just perhaps how the owl may shed some light on these mysteriously dark phenomena. Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
When I first heard about your work, obviously everyone considers you the owl guy. You Google your name, you type in owl or UFO, and you are the first thing that always pops up. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. So let's start with owls. Not in the UFO or abduction sense, but owls in general. These creatures, they've taken on many, you know, mythic symbology throughout history. You once stated seeing through the darkness to bring messages. Could you sort of give us a brief history of the owl throughout different cultures?
Well, that's easier said than done. The owl is, just by its very nature, an owl is intense, right? I mean, a real owl is intense, especially the big owls. Little owls tend to be sort of cute and adorable, but the big ones tend to be sort of spooky and threatening. You know, we're dealing with an animal that has a presence. People recognize that. I'm convinced that the cave dwellers of our ancient ancestors, if they walked out and saw an owl, would have the same visceral reaction that we do now, which is one of, I almost want to say, I mean, there's something, you know, threatening about an owl. They're not they have these huge eyes. And they have this eerie stare, and I think that just translates into something that taps into us at a deep level. So So that's sort of the starting point, you know, just, you know, straight up owls are intense looking. Mm-hmm. The mythologies of the owl, I mean, if you that's all over the map, right? I mean, it's a great big globe and there's owls everywhere. You know, it's you know, the Eskimos have owls and they have owls down in the jungles of Peru. So we all have, you know, we being, you know, the world's culture, collectively, we all have these owl stories that stretch back forever. Now, what we're dealing with is trying to like pick out the main thread that seems to connect all these. So the owls are capable of, you know, what can only be called magic in some sense. Obviously, it's just physiology. It's their big eyes and their soft feathers, but they can see into the night. They can see into the darkness astoundingly well. I've done a bunch of research on this. And they, you know, so they have nocturnal vision and they also have silent flight in a way that is, you know, quite eerie when you see an owl flying. So they are, you know, that ability to see into the darkness very quickly translates to traveling into other realms. This becomes a metaphor. You know, they travel into the darkness and then they would return. The ancient myths would be they would return with a message. If the shaman has any totem animal, it would be the owl. And that's perfect because what the shaman would do would be to, you know, go through some sort of ritual, and then the shaman would travel to another realm. That ritual might be meditating or rhythmic dancing or taking some sort of psychedelic mushroom or something. But the shaman would, you know, travel to another realm metaphorically. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're just sitting in their hut when they do it or wherever they are. And then they would return with a message. Now, that's the symbology of the owl in a very simple way. You know, what that message might be, that's up for debate. That can be interpreted any number of ways. But the owl itself, as a physical being, you know, is connected to these ancient lores, and I feel strongly that these ancient lores are acting out present day. You know, when I was working on the book, people would ask me, "So, you know, what have you been working on lately?" And I'm like, "Well, I got this book project. Oh, what's it on? Oh, well, it's about owls. Owls. That's interesting. Well, what about owls?" And then I would have to size the person up, right? Kind of check them out. Kind of go, "Okay, do I drop the UFO bomb?" And I usually said, "Oh, you know, it's a book about owl mythology," which I feel was honest. And they'd go, "Oh, that's interesting." And then they'd kind of want to hear a little more about that. So the case I would argue in that very cautious form without introducing the UFO weirdness was that the owl is performing the same role present day that it performed for ancient man, and that what I'm collecting, I mean, you're holding the book in your hand, or it's there nearby, I suspect. And I mean, it, in many ways, that book is just a collection of one story after another of people who have had these strange owl experiences. And I feel all those people are being genuine. And my sense is that people throughout the millennia, people throughout all history have had odd owl experiences. And the lore, the mythos emerged from those direct experiences. So that's I sort of argue that, you know, what's taking place present day has been with us since the dawn of time.
Right, right. And you mentioned, you know, the owl experiences throughout time. You sort of described this not so much as finding a pattern, but that it was, I believe it was in your intro, you mentioned it's more of a mood or a vibe. Could you sort of elaborate on that a little bit of what it means to you?
Well, yeah. I mean, so, you know, like if, you know, this is owls or UFOs? We're still on owls?
We're doing owls.
Okay,
yeah.
We're still on owls.
Definitely,
okay, so owls,
go deep into UFOs.
You know, like I feel like I'm an artist and an illustrator rather than a scientist or a academic, right? So I'm working off my gut, you know. So you hear two stories back to back, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, they like I'm tapping into the, right, the the mood of these stories. You know, the story might not be the same exact story, but it has that similar vibe. I mean, I often refer back to the campfire story, like the eerie campfire story. You know, it's often those stories don't have an ending. You know, they're just meant to be evocative of a mood. And I find that the owl experiences, especially, you know, so owls show up at the point of death. People see owls at funerals. People will have an owl land on their window and then find out that, you know, a sibling or a family member or a parent died at that moment that the owl was there or shortly after. So owls are, you know, on a very that's very common, the death imagery and the connection with the passing on, especially of a loved one. So and that's right interwoven into the mystique and folklore and mythology of the owls. So, you know, you might hear two stories and an academic may say, well, you know, I put this on the spreadsheet and I check this box here and I check this box here, and you look at the columns, they don't line up. So they're not the same story. You know, I don't know why you're comparing and contrasting these two stories. And I'm like, no, but these stories have a similar tenor. You know, there's a flavor to them. It's like saying, you know, how to, you know, like two forms of music might come from, you know, two different sections of the record store, but you know, there's a similarity to the music, and that's not up to a, you don't have to catalog that and dissect it with the eyes of a scientist. You sort of have to step back and do it at an intuitive level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, relating to that, you mentioned in the book about the allure of vowels in cinema or media, and I know you and I on occasion have contacted one another when we've seen owls in movies or in the background of things. What do you think this means in terms of the way art or I guess Hollywood or show business, what does it mean to them when you see these symbols in the movies, or does it take on many different forms?
Well, you know, that's you have a haunted house movie, right? And then, you know, the person approaches the haunted house and there's an owl hooting in the distance, right? You just hear it on the soundtrack. It's, you know, there's no one had to plan that out. You know, it wasn't like a conspiracy of people trying to indoctrinate, you know, the populace. Mm-hmm. That was just the guy in the editing room who went and got a stock bit of audio footage or audio of an owl hooting and just overlaid it into the movie. Now, this is happening. It's 20th century, 21st century. You know, owls are showing up in spooky, you know, like little kids have, you know, owl decorations that show up in their elementary school, thumbtacked to the bulletin board on Halloween. You know, this is happening present day. Now, you go back, I mean, the Bible has owls in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've carefully looked at those and tried to pull out the symbology of those owls. And it's a little murky, you know, like I don't sense any deeper meaning. It seems to have the same meaning as the, you know, owl in the haunted house movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a great owl cameo in The Bride of Frankenstein. You know, early on in the film, there's this owl shows up and it just flies into the scene and sits on a little, it's in a barn or like the basement of an old mill. And it's right before a woman dies, you know, she gets, and so you know, there it is. There's the haunted house movie. There's the death symbology. It's like meant to be a set piece in a spooky, you know, in a spooky bit of entertainment, you know, and it plays that way in the Bible too, where these owls show up. They're not really there symbolizing anything. They're not really key to the story. They're sort of used as a set piece. People will talk about how barren the desert is, and they say it's a place of owls, which is, you know, that's like how spooky the forest is. It's a place of owls. That's the haunted house version. So, you know, I think that this is over 2,000 years. This is the owl has had the same lore.
Right.
And I think the darkness meant meant something totally different in the era before the electric light.
Yeah. Well, in terms of your research of the owl experiences, Mike, this is a question from one of our listeners, actually. Have you noticed any specific type of owl that seems to be most prominent when these experiences come up, whether it be synchronistic or UFO related or just owls, like you mentioned earlier, in general?
Well, I mean, not really. You know what I mean? So there's mean, obviously it depends on where you are. You know, you're not going to see a snowy owl if you live in Florida.
Exactly.
And you're not going to see, a barred owl if you live in Arizona. So there's so you're locked into this location. You know, like I've sort of given up in a way. Like, you know, I'm people seeing, owls at an appropriate time on a t-shirt or like at a prescient moment on a TV ad, you know, like I actually factor those kind of things in too. So, so there's no specific owl. Obviously the most iconic owl would be the great horned owl, and that's a North American owl. That's simply, that owl doesn't exist over in Europe. So they have a different owl. That's the Eurasian eagle owl, which is essentially the same thing as our great horned owl. So, you know, we're dealing with, I don't know. I mean, just this, the chance, how to, you know, like whatever the universe is offering up something, you know, the universe is setting something in someone's path and, you know, tiny little owls show up too. You know, these little owls, there's a lot of owls are very small, which, you know, most people don't realize. And the smaller the owl, the less likely you will see them because the more likely they are to come out only at night. So, you know, people won't see a saw-whet owl. They might see a great gray owl because those are the ones that will come out at dusk and dawn. And people might actually get a glimpse of them.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about the size of owls a little bit later because we have a lot to talk about in terms of that. Now, Mike, I know you've had some extremely powerful experiences, sort of a one defining moment of just, you know, a profound experience with several different owls appearing all at once. What is the owl alarm clock that you describe in the book? Because I know this was sort of an awakening for you. What does this term mean to you, the owl alarm clock?
Well, the owl as alarm clock would be, that's just, like people say, like, well, you know, what does owl mean? You know, and I kind of have to have an answer, right? I can't kind of just brush them off and say, oh, I don't know, which I don't know, really. I mean, but what I have found is there's a pattern where the owl shows up at a point. And I've had a handful of people say this, you know, well, more than a handful, you know, people say that, you know, that they had sort of an awakening experience or the owl set them on a path. And that was certainly true of my case where I saw a bunch of owls. This would have been 2006. I was camping, two separate camping events, right? So just only a few days apart, the same mountain range, but not in the same location. And as the sun was setting, you know, me and the person I was camping with, her name is Kristen, we saw three owls at sunset. A few days later, we saw the same thing happen, three owls at sunset. I'm convinced they're the same three owls, even though we weren't in the same spot. In that moment, seeing those owls, I had the very clear thought that this has something to do with UFOs. And it was that event. You know, when you get right down to it, it's not that exciting of an event, right? You know, like, oh, some owls flew around and they landed, which is unusual, very unusual, but it's not like, you know, it's not like the heavens opened up and, you know, the angels, you know, came down or something like that. It was just, you know, these were normal owls in a setting where owls, you know, were certainly around. But the impact it had on me was really profound. It set me on the journey that I'm on now, the journey that created that book, and the journey that I'm you know, still continuing as I talk to you now, and I answer letters and talk to other people who have had these experiences. Very simply, an alarm clock wakes you up, right? So if someone's asleep, you know, just nudging them may not wake them. And shaking them, you know, may not wake them either. So if someone's really asleep, you send in the owls. And that's kind of my sense. And it would have to be for a specific reason. Like it seems like the owls are connected to something. And it's a little elusive what they're connected to. And they may be, one way to look at it is the owl may be the totem of a transformative process, right? So the change. So from being asleep to being awake would be a change, and not in the, you know, whatever, getting up in the morning kind of thing. I'm talking at a more deep spiritual level, being awake to a deeper reality. And that's what the owl resonates for me after sort of wallowing in this research for all these years.
Right, and I know you personally struggled for a long time with several experiences you had involving possible contact with UFO occupants, UFOs in general. And you sort of consider this this event of 2006 with the owls a culmination of that it's somehow connected? Is that
I mean, up until that point, I had been completely denying these events. I mean, if I told the events, they sound exactly like what anyone who's ever read a UFO abduction book, mm-hmm. you know, you missing time, seeing aliens in the, you know, out a window in a yard, you know, seeing UFOs at close range, you know. So I had these experiences growing up and well into my, and one event took place in my 30s mm-hmm. or as I was 30 years old. And I managed to just deny all that. I just push it all away and just ignore it and deny it. But I'll have to say, at the same time, that stuff was bubbling over, a little pressure cooker, you know, like was just set on simmer and slowly got hotter and hotter. And there came a point when there was sort of a crack in the dam, and that was the owls were that crack in the dam. And after that, the dam burst. Right. And I set off on my own journey of self-exploration, where I really said, you know, like, I'm going to figure this out. I didn't figure it out. Mm-hmm. Just as baffled in a way now as I was at any point along the thing. But I do feel like I feel like I've got a clearer sense of who I am in all this, in the sense that, you know, I feel that the events that I described and denied, I'm no longer denying. I feel those really happened, and then the implication is exactly what they appear to be.
Right. A huge step for any experiencer, I can only imagine. So where in the grand scheme of things does synchronicity play into this? You know, being the second, you know, sort of subtitle of the book, could you briefly go over what synchronicity is, where the term sort of came from, and how it leads into the whole owl connection?
Well, synchronicity is a term that was coined by Carl Jung, and I think in the 1920s he was coined due to a series of experiences that he had in conjunction with a physicist named Wolfgang Pauli. The simplest definition of synchronicity would be a coincidence that is meaningful to the observer. And, you know, there's run-of-the-mill coincidences, right? And stuff's going to happen all the time, you know, but there's coincidences that take on a deeper, meaningful aspect. And oftentimes it's very difficult to explain those to people. It's sort of like explaining a dream, you know, like, oh my God, this thing happened, and right then this happened, and then you try to explain it, and it's so subjective that the people just kind of roll their eyes and can't follow you. And I recognize that that's almost inherent in what a synchronicity might, you know, be. It's meant for the individual. I spoke with a friend of mine. This is going back a few years ago, and I kind of was on my high horse, and I'd been doing a bunch of research. And it's one of the questions I ask, you know, people who've had the UFO contact experience, or UFO abductees, or whatever term you want to use, experiencers. Mm-hmm. I would say, hey, so what about synchronicities? Do you have synchronicities in your life? And they usually just roll their eyes, you know, it's like trying to ask a fish if it ever experiences water. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I said, you know, like, so I said to my friend, I said, you know, people have the UFO contact experience. They have more synchronicities than the normal folks, than Joe Normal. She looked at me and she rolled her eyes and she said, you know, anyone on a spiritual path will have more synchronicities. And immediately I recognized she was right. And, you know, the next step, you know, if that's the case, then UFO abduction is a spiritual path. And so I kind of equate UFO abduction as a spiritual path. I mean, I said the owl is the totem animal of the transformative experience. And you mean, you know, the transformative experience can be a shamanic initiation. It can be a powerful meditation. It can be a near death experience, or it can be death itself. I mean, and I also will argue that You know, the UFO contact experience is transformative by its nature, by its intent. It transforms the individual, not right away, maybe over decades, maybe over a lifetime, but the individual will be transformed. But this synchronicity would be just, and it's also, you know, people overuse that word a lot, and I'm sure I do too. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes people will say like, oh my God, I had a dream and I dreamed in the dream that I was going to see an owl on the ride to work today. And I did see an owl. Isn't that a powerful synchronicity? And like, well, that's technically not a synchronicity. It's a premonition. So those are different. So synchronicity is when, there's a coincidence, you know, so that's not a coincidence. So so both of those can be powerful and mystical experiences, but one's called a premonition and one's called a synchronicity.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had a pretty powerful, I guess, coincidence happen in researching synchronicity. You spoke to Dr. Surprise, and could you give us, you know, sort of the background of how you came to find his work and just exactly what happened when you looked further into his work and found some eerily similar
well, this is actually, yeah, it turned into a whole chapter of the book.
Yeah.
I heard him on a podcast. He had a book. He was promoting a book straight up. He'd written a book. He's promoting it. He's doing the podcast scene. You know, he's talking about his book. The book title of the book is Synchronicity. His name is Dr. Kirby Surprise, which is a great name. He got a real thoughtful set of ideas about the source of synchronicity. He argues that the observer, the individual, is creating the synchronicity, that we as individuals, our consciousness, our intention can affect reality. So you take in a scientific experiment, you know, someone rolls a dice, right? And then they do it 100 times. And then they're trying to create get more one number series more than another. It should be random, right? They flip a coin. They do it 100 times. They try to get heads more than tails. It should be random. It's not. What happens is that people will get, you know, if they want heads more than tails, they'll get heads more than tails. And this has been known in the sciences for nearly 100 years. And nobody wants to, like, really, you know, tackle this one. The implication is that the individual, the guy flipping the coin, is affecting reality. He's affecting the way the coin lands. And the same thing could be said of synchronicity. The individual, according to Dr. Kirby Surprise, I like the magical aspect of it. He says it's welling up from the person. So I call him up, or excuse me, I send him an email and I say, I'm paraphrasing this from memory. It's in the book verbatim from the actual email. And I say, listen, I'm doing this research. I've had these UFO experiences. I'm talking to a lot of UFO contactees and experiencers. And from what I can glean, they're having more synchronicities than the rest of the population. And he gets back to me and he says, you know, I've had my own direct experience with UFOs and that's not how it works. And I'm like, wait a minute. The guy who writes a book about synchronicity says he's had his own UFO experiences and he writes a book about synchronicity and he's kind of proving my point, right? That they're connected. And so I kind of like said as much in the follow-up letter and he's kind of like, okay, look, just get the book, read the book and let's talk. So I got the book. I read the book and I can't remember what page it's on. It's like on page, 226, you know? So I turn the page, I get to this thing and I scroll down and he's describing how the individual can ask synchronicity, you know, just like ask of the universe, just ask for synchronicity to present itself and manifest synchronicities. You can just ask, and that's his argument. And so I read on, and this is all very interesting, and he says, I like to make owls.
Ooh.
So the guy who has the UFO experience, who writes the book on synchronicities, when he wants to manifest his own synchronicities, he creates owl synchronicities. I literally dropped out of the chair when he said that. So I get a hold of him and we talk and I'm very cautious to how, I mean, so someone has given me permission to tell their story. So I need to honor that. And
of course.
And his UFO experiences are very interesting. They're very subtle. They're not, you know, what you would see on a late night, exploitative cable TV documentary. Mm-hmm. So he's had experiences in his youth. He started meditating when he was 9 and has been actively meditating ever since. And he, in his early 20s, was, and he said it was, he felt like he was in communication with some higher form of intelligence. Presently, he feels that's his own intelligence that he was interacting with, basically interacting with his own higher self. At the time, he didn't think that. At the time, he felt, you know, it must be an outside source, and the only thing that made sense was, you know, aliens on board a flying saucer. So he would go out at night and try to contact these things, and little dots in the sky, little eerie lights would appear. And now he'd have his friends. He'd say, okay, there's going to be a little dot in the sky. It's going to appear right over there. We're going to have a UFO. And then sure enough, it would happen. He would frighten his friends. And so those were his experiences. Now, when I asked into talking with him, you know, he said, listen, you, like I described my life, like, oh my God, I'm just immersing myself. I've just like thrown myself into this owl UFO thing, and it's my own experience, and I'm trying to make sense of it, and I'm wrestling with it, and I'm reaching out to anyone. And he said, listen, you're putting a lot of intention into that, and this is how reality works. Reality will reflect that back, and you should expect to have synchronicities. You are manifesting synchronicities. And I had to think, like, well, like, did I actually manifest Kirby Surprise? I mean, he's the perfect person to bat these ideas around with. And we actually talked on Halloween night of all nights, which is just perfect.
Yeah.
So he's a very thoughtful guy, very smart thinker, and a clinician at the same time, very mystical in the way he frames these ideas, which was a perfect match for the way I am more comfortable framing these things. So. Yeah, so the guy who writes the book about synchronicity, you know, gets his own chapter in my book on UFOs and owls, and I mean, obviously, I can't paraphrase the entire chapter, but his ideas and his very thoughtful outlook, you know, helped me a lot along my way in this journey.
Wow, that chapter struck me. More than most, and really put the synchronicity at the forefront, and sort of delineating between coincidence and synchronicity and manifesting that. So yeah, very, very interesting. Mike, I want to sort of move into the most, I guess, controversial and powerful part of your book, the UFO and the abductee. Now, I do want to dive into screen memory a little bit, but before we get there, I want to go into UFOs and owls in general. Now, you have many people in your book who have experienced this, whether it was the UFO first and then owl, or owl and then UFO. Could you briefly touch on that, the physical, you know, tangible reality of the UFO and the owl?
Ugh, I wish I could sum this up succinctly. You know, like there was someone at a conference and she kind of said, like, you know, I saw your talk and it was called UFOs and Owls. I had no idea where you were going to go. This didn't make any sense to me. She had no idea what she was getting into. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards she said, oh, you did a nice job of summing it up. And it's like, well, it took me like 2 hours. There is no easy answer. So, mm-hmm. So after my experience in 2006, started looking into this. I just got shameless. I would just pick up the phone and call people, and people who had, you know, contact experiences. I would just figure out a way to get a hold of them and talk to them. And now, one of the questions I asked everyone, like everyone, researcher, experiencer, you know, like, have you ever had any odd experiences with owls? Now, it's not 100%, but it's enough that there's a defined, palpable pattern that shows up. So I asked the question, have you ever had any odd experiences with owls? They'll say, you know, that's funny you should ask. No one's ever asked that before. And I did have this really strange experience. And, you know, sometimes it's as subtle as there's a woman named Nadine Lalich, and she's an abductee, very outspoken and clear about her experiences. Very level-headed. She's a great spokesman for the whole cause. So she said, you know, that's funny you should ask. You know, no one's really asked me that. But there was a time when I was living in this apartment, and you could just tell she was kind of like, well, this is odd. I was living in this apartment, and it was right at the time I was having a lot of contact experiences, and there was always an owl outside the house and outside the window. And I would come home from work and there'd be an owl. I mean, a big owl would be right on the branch right by the door when I came home. And that shows up, you know, like, oh, the owl would, like, you know, I'd get up in the morning, the owl would be on the branch, and I'd come home from work and the owl would be on the branch staring at me. So that happens in the lives of abductees. There's another guy, Ron Johnson, who has stories like that. Mm-hmm. Another way would be that one of the first people that contacted me in this whole research was this guy, Derek. And he said, yeah, you know, I was camping in the desert and looked up at this cactus and there was an owl. Both me and my friend, we were lying there looking up at the stars and it startled us. Really eerie, right? Owl looking down at you. You're lying on your back in the desert sand and looking up at this owl and beautiful stars behind it. And I was like, well, they, you know, it's like, and I know just what he means. It is eerie. And the owl flies off. Moments later, a triangle UFO floats past them very silently, and it's hugging the natural terrain of the landscape in this very eerie way. They're in this canyon, and I met him, and he mimicked this flight pattern, and it was really, you know, so you could see he was kind of gritting his teeth as he was telling the story. This was a, you know, weird, powerful event. So owls and UFOs show up side by side. As you said, sometimes the, you know, the UFO will show up first, sometimes the owl will show up first. These are real owls we're talking about. These aren't the, right, the screen memory aspect, which we can get into in a little bit. So yeah, so why? I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, like I wrestle through the entire book trying to come up with the why. I still don't. You know, I think I type why owls ? A full sentence, you know, mm-hmm. 10 times throughout the book. And I never quite, you know, I dance around it and speculate a little bit on what it might mean. But yeah, hard to know. But my sense, my very strong sense, is these are intimately connected in some way. You know, there's a lot of UFO books out there. You know, books have been around for, you know, 30 years. And you can go and peel through, go through those pages and, you know, a big thick book might have a paragraph or two on owls. And I made an effort to dig up and look back at a lot of those. And you know, they're telling these odd little stories just like I just told. And so the seeds were there. Like, I didn't invent this subject. I mean, it was already there. And I just dug a little deeper and put it all in one book. I don't know the reason. I can say with great conviction that there is a connection. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I mean, and you make very, startling connections between, you know, a silent bird in flight and a silent object in flight, whether it's triangular, saucer-shaped, so that was very interesting. And I know,
and you know what else happens a lot? Yeah. I'll do it. I'll probably do it before the dog is up.
Yeah.
Is, I mean, they're both three letters. I cannot tell you how many times I typed them wrong.
Oh, good.
You know,
point.
You're working on this book and I wanted to type owl and I would type UFO, right?
Interchangeable.
Yeah. I mean, it's like it was just interchangeable in a way that they blurred together. Yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting. I never even thought about that one. Well, yeah, you say, you know, there throughout UFO literature, there's always that one or two paragraph and you sort of brush past it. But I know that one individual in particular was the first to comment on your blog about that. Would you mind telling us a little bit about that? One of the preeminent writers on the UFO.
You're talking about Whitley?
Abductee, yeah, literature.
Whitley Strieber.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So Whitley, this is interesting. So I just spoke with Whitley. Mm-hmm. I was interviewed on his show, and oh my God, he was so complimentary. I was a little bit like, whatever. Someone said he could hear me blushing on the the book, the most important abduction book in the history of the subject is Communion, hands down.
Absolutely.
You know, some people will, and whatever, there's all kinds of. Whatever. Some people don't buy it, and some people are like, anyway. So I trust the guy. Mm-hmm. If anything is his problem, if anything's working against Whitley Strieber, it's his own skill at writing. He writes so beautifully that you're holding this book in your hand and like, is this fiction? Is this real? It's like, it's so. I mean, he's an A+ writer in a field that doesn't have that very often. So, very early on in the book, he describes what we would now just call a nighttime bedroom visitation, an abduction. Maybe he doesn't use that word.
Right.
I do. I just use it just because that's the vocabulary word we're saddled with. You know, mm-hmm. I don't like it, but that's the one that gets used a lot. And so he describes a bedroom visitation on the day after Christmas in 1985. The next morning, he actually felt there was an owl flying around the house. There was an owl in the house, which seemed impossible. His wife was like, there wasn't any owl in the house last night. All the windows are closed. It's wintertime. And then he said, oh, so the only thing it could be was the owl out the window, and it would have come through that window. I know it. And they went over to the window, and he looked, and there was fresh snow, and there was no footprints on the windowsill. Or on the, you know, so the snow had fallen a few days before. So if there was an owl on that windowsill, there should have been some evidence, and there wasn't. And when he saw that, he knew something far stranger had occurred than just a physical owl. So somehow this memory of an owl was implanted in his mind. And that, that in the research circles in is referred to as the screen memory, which is bandied about and is very commonplace. And what will happen is people will tell stories of driving down a lonely road at night, and they turn a corner and there's a great big tall 4 foot tall owl standing in the middle of the road. And they'll pull their car right up to it, and the owl will be above the hood of the car, staring in at their windshield. Now, there's no such thing as a 4 foot tall owl. They don't get that tall. There's no owl in the world that could stand on the road, no matter how small your car is, and then stare over the hood at you. So they're seeing something else. That the implication being that they're seeing a gray alien that has somehow used a psychic projection, some sort of hypnotic mask, and then the observer, quite probably the abductee, doesn't see a gray alien with big black eyes. They see an owl with big penetrating eyes. And that shows up in the literature over and over again. I did a chapter on screen memories, and I actually tried to – I did it early in the book, and I wanted to get past it because – you know, that once you wrap your mind around what the screen memory might be and how it's used, you know, what I was more interested in was not that, but the stranger aspect of the real owl. Like, why are these real owls showing up? So.
No, and you said, Mike, I mean, you know, being that it may be a quote unquote fallible screen memory, that the biggest owls often get to what, 2-3 feet maybe?
Well, if you look at the straight Google research, is 33 inches, the biggest owl I've ever found written in is size. 33 inches, and that's in flight, nose to tail. Mm-hmm. So that's not standing.
Okay.
So it'd be a little shorter than that. So, I mean, if you see an owl a little over 1 foot tall in North America, you're seeing a big owl, and there's only one owl that can get that big, and that you have to be in pretty far north to see an owl that big, and that would be the great gray owl. That's not going to be that big. In no way could it be 4 foot tall. You know, I mean, maybe if off in the distance, you might, you know, how do you accurately perceive what it might be? So, you know, there's a 2.5 foot tall, maybe, but yeah, very, very difficult so what's interesting is that people will see these tall owls, these 4 foot tall owls, and then just dismiss them. Like, oh yeah, I saw a 4 foot tall owl. And then they'll say it as casually as that. And then like, they'll recognize there's something odd in there. I made a cardboard owl that was 4 foot tall. Let me tell you.
I remember.
Stand next to this thing. Yeah. Oh, that's right.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Actually held it. Yeah, you yep. stood right next to it. Yeah, you stand next to this thing, and there's no way that you could mistake. There's no way that could be real.
Right.
So owls are, hawks are bigger than owls and things like that. So eagles are bigger than owls. And there's, so.
Yeah, I mean, sort of bringing it back around, your blog, hiddenexperience.blogspot, you wrote about the owl and the UFO abductee, and out of nowhere, Mr. Strieber was the first to comment on the blog. I mean, that's pretty...
You know, it's very interesting.
Right,
yeah, so the very first day of the blog's incarnation, I put three stories up. One of the stories was was titled Owls at Sunset. You can just scroll back right to the very beginning to the blog, and there's the very first day, which is March. Good God, it's got to be around... I think it's March 5th or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Right around here. So that was, it's 7 years now. It's 2006. That was 2009 or 2016. And now it's 2009. Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. 7 years of the blog's incarnation. Okay.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Lucky,
oh my God.
Number seven.
Yeah. So, so the very first day Whitley Strieber commented, I found out afterwards that it was Mac Tony's, a researcher out of St. Louis, a friend of mine, mm-hmm. who was on Twitter at the time, and somehow he had gotten on the shared Twitter feed with Whitley, and then he had commented that, oh, there's this cool set of articles. And so Whitley read the Owls at Sunset thing and commented on the very first day, mm-hmm. which is bizarre, right? I mean, you know, you start a blog and then, like, it's the very, very first day.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, so I remember, and his comment was sort of, it was actually poetic and cryptic. And I actually, you know, Whitley had a chat room thing that he used to do on Wednesday nights on this subscriber site. And I would go in the chat room, and he, I think, is capable of just zipping off like a three sentence little reply that is so heavy and laden with deep meaning. And I think he just does that. I don't think he can help it, you know?
Yeah.
I think when he's in the toothpaste aisle trying to pick out, you know, like which toothpaste to get, he's probably, you know, it's probably equally as laden with deep meaning. And you know, when he has the conversation with the, you know, the checkout girl about, you know, like, you know, does he want paper or plastic? You know, he's probably equally as powerful as a communicator. But yeah, so he made a comment about you know, God and owls coming in threes and a deeper meaning and being surrendered to God, and it comes across as very poetic. And I included that in the book too. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, sort of tying it back to just the UFO experience in specific, Mike. You refer to Joe Mantaldo, UFO researcher, who claims that UFO sightings can often be a trigger to other events having happened to a witness. Now, do you necessarily agree with this? If so, what do you think that means? You know, what is one event a trigger to past events, I guess?
Well, you know, I mean, like, so the way Joe Mantaldo argues this is that, you know, the owl is there as a marker.
Okay.
Right. So the owl is marking the occasion. And so if you have an event, right, you're driving down the road at night and then suddenly, you know, something weird happens. You see a great big owl, and then, you know, later you might use that owl. It's like, you know, there was that night I saw the owl. There was something unusual about that night. That may be the starting point for your own self-examination.
Mm-hmm.
So he says that he basically argues he says ET doesn't need to make himself known, right? He can do everything using complete stealth. The The flying saucers can be completely cloaked and no one ever needs to see them. The techniques of mind control and erasing someone's memory can be so perfect and so streamlined and so complete that no one ever needs to see the aliens. Yeah. So if they're being seen, it is because they want to be seen. Now, I don't know if that's necessarily true or not, but that's his argument. So his sense is if we're remembering an owl, if people are seeing an owl and remembering an owl, it is happening for a reason. They want that memory to be in place for some reason. He senses it's to trigger a later form of examination, self-examination, or to as a marker of like the point when an event may have occurred.
Mm. Interesting. Now, would this connect to what you consider the maybe people?
Well, the maybe people it's actually sort of you talk to these folks, you know, you're like, oh God, so what happened? Well, I was out, camping in the desert and I saw this owl and then I saw this UFO and then the UFO flew over and like, it's like, okay, well, that's interesting. And then you kind of listen to their story. It's like, what do you think you've ever been abducted? And I'll ask it straight out and they'll say, oh no, nope, never been abducted. Not me, never happened. Then you'll talk to them for a little while and they'll have a little other odd stories. And they'll say, you know, I had a spiritual awakening. Or they'll say, I had these vivid dreams that played out like contact events. Now, none of that is proof, right? Mm-hmm. So my sense is that there's a lesser tier on the ladder, one rung down from abductee. People are still influenced, seemingly influenced by some outside force, but they don't have that pop culture experience of being taken on board a flying saucer and put on the table. You know, that may never have happened, but still these people are out there. They're playing a role. And then you talk to these people deeper and then they're like, what do you do? Oh, I'm a Reiki therapist or I'm an artist. You know, they have these, there's these things that seem to show up in the research. And for some reason, either maybe it's just me that I'm like drawing these people in, but the Reiki therapy thing is out of control. I mean, it feels like, you know, half the people I talk to are Reiki therapists who've had these experiences. So the maybe people are the, like if someone doesn't say they're, if someone said, like, if they don't say they're a UFO abductee, it ain't my job to call them that, you know, like that's up to them. And I might suspect as much. And I would even argue that some percentage, perhaps a high percentage of the people in the book that I call maybe people are actually experiencers, abductees that simply don't remember their contact experience. But without doing the proper research and without, you know, I mean, I would just, how would you prove that? You can't, you know? Right. So I'm left with this sense that there's a lesser rung in the ladder, but still these people are they've experienced something.
Mm-hmm. No, I know you personally haven't chosen to take the hypnotic regression approach.
Oh, right? I have. I've tried it a few times.
You have? Okay.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Three times I've tried it for the contact experience stuff. And each time I'm unsuccessful, once with Leo Sprinkle, okay, once with Barbara Lamb, and once with Bud Hopkins. So.
Oh, wow. Now do you see this as a viable option for many experiencers? Do you think it is of value and actually works to, you know, bring these experiences forward? I guess what I'm asking is, do you see it as a healthy way of dealing with these experiences?
You know, my sense is you should probably exhaust other avenues first.
Okay.
Before jumping on the hypnotherapist's couch. You know, I also, like, I talk to people all the time. Mm-hmm. And I bet you it is like 1% of the people I talk to have actually been through hypnotic regression for this type of thing. And that's you know, that's contrary to what the popular culture is. They think that everyone, you know, the only reason you can ever, you know, there's people who would argue with Jeff Ritzman and Jeremy Vaney would argue that it's the, you know, the hypnotherapists who've polluted the pool And you know, given all these stories, my sense is, you know, like, we don't need, I mean, like, there's plenty of evidence out there. People have remembered all kinds of things without hypnosis.
Right. I know Kathleen Martin's done a lot of research into that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, people. So that's even, but Hopkins kind of rolled his eyes and said, you know, a lot of people show up my office, you know, they don't need hypnosis. They got all kinds of conscious memory. We don't need to prove anything. Yeah. So, you know, it's a tool. I guess it can be used prudently and, you know, can be used irresponsibly. And, you know, that's a subjective argument, you know, like, which is, you know, how we're on the continuum, you know, like, one end is irresponsible hypnotherapy and one end is irresponsible hypnotherapy. I mean, where in the line does it fall? You know, I mean, you know, every case is different. Every individual is different. Every, you know, person trying to make a judgment call is going to be different. So sure, I bet you there's been some sloppy things taking place. I bet you. Now, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who've gone through hypnotherapy, and then you ask them, like, well, how was it? You know, like, and they say, I didn't believe it, didn't buy it.
I've run across that many times myself, yeah.
And that doesn't make it into the literature, you know, like, it seems like, you know, there's this illusion that you have this hypnotherapy thing, and you're all of a sudden, you're like, there's this, like, little, you know, the magic wand gets zapped to your head, and there's this, like, Disney ping noise, and all of a sudden you have all your memories back, and it don't work that way.
Exactly.
So, yeah,
It's true.
I would do it. And in fact, there's going to be a day when I'll probably give into it. And I'll, quite honestly, like, some of the events that I had were really scary. Since then, I've had a couple other events that weren't as scary. And so they don't have the big, they, like, it's a little easier to like, oh, I'll just investigate that one. Cause it's not as scary. That one over there that happened at night, it was super spooky and like, yeah, it freaked me out. And it haunted me for years. And then I had this other thing back in March of 2013. And it's like, you know, that was kind of nice. It was kind of pleasant. You know, didn't have any, there's no associated baggage to that one, you know. I don't have any. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
It's hard. I spoke to a woman a week ago who had an initial experience, and she thought it was the only one. And, you know, she came to me a week later, and she's struggling to make a decision with her husband. You know, I want to go under. I want to sort of find out what happened. She has glimpses of a second experience, but she's terrified to find out what it might be. So again, when these things become deeply traumatic, every hypnotherapist I've spoken to who deal with abductees or experiencers, they all say the same thing. Look, if you're having a traumatic experience, seek actual therapy first or find what works for you. If not, we're here to talk to you. So like you said, there's not this magic wand that brings everything to the surface. Every hypnotherapist I've spoken to is very responsible, and they look out for the person first and foremost. So as long as you're smart about it, I think it's definitely a viable option.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I went through a hypnotherapy session where it was a past life regression. It was very therapeutic, very therapeutic for some, like, emotional issues that, you know, may or may not be tied into this other stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was just this story emerged of a life that I lived in the 1920s or the 19-teens. It was hard to pinpoint exactly. And, you know, when it was, like, died under crappy circumstances, and, you know, like, maybe the baggage from that previous life is, like, kind of lingering and causing problems in this life. That said, you know, like, I don't know if it actually happened. I do know that it was very therapeutic to go through the process of examining this set of hypnotically induced memories. Are they real memories from a previous life? I have no idea. What I can say is that the result of the procedure was powerfully therapeutic. Now, while lying there on the, this is in the hypnotherapist, her name is Lorraine Flaherty, and she's out of London, while sitting there on her, like, recliner couch thing there, and you know, she addressed the UFO stuff. She said, okay, we're going to talk about the UFO thing now. And I'm like, okay. It's like, so, you know, what does your higher self need to tell you? That's how she phrased it. Mm-hmm. Said in my house, and like, my answer was, this is real. This is really happening. It really happened. It's like, okay, now if you could ask and why is this happening? And my response was, because it's important. And it was this little kind of thing where she would say, and why are they doing this? Why are they taking you? Because they have to. You know, it wasn't, you know, it was so that my sense is that whatever's going on, and I'm whatever, like, I could have been making this up, or I don't know. So I don't have complete trust in it, you know, but it was painted something. You know, it wasn't like, you know, they're taking my sperm to make hybrids, you know, that kind of thing. That's not the answer I gave. The answer I gave was, you know, why are they here? The answer was, it's important. So I do recognize that there's something heavy about this experience.
Right. And it's, you know, the continuing of the journey, you know, to find those answers, I would assume. I know, Mike, you had an experience outside your bedroom window with the quote-unquote grays. I wanted to ask you, because I know throughout the book you also spoke to others who have come into contact with the grays, and they have this sense of maybe the Oz factor or some sense of, okay, I'm shutting down. You know, what do you perceive this as? You know, this calmness that comes over in such a not calm moment, as it were.
Well, yeah. So I had a experience. This would have been in the winter of 92, 93, mm-hmm. January or February in 93. I was living in rural Maine. I woke up in the middle of the night. There was a bright light shining in the bedroom window. I sat up in bed. I looked out the window, and there were five spindly gray aliens walking towards the house, and they were backlit by this bright light. Now, you know, that's frightening, right? I should have freaked out. I should have got up. I should have locked the door. I should have grabbed a baseball bat. And, but I didn't. I heard this calm voice in my head say, "Oh yes, they're here. Now is the time to put your head on the pillow and shut down." And that's exactly what I did. I mean, I probably saw this for 30 seconds. But the associated with that was a weird sense. It's accurate to say it was dreamlike. It's not accurate to say it was a dream. It was very vivid. There's sort of head in the fishbowl quality to the thing. Very clear, very quiet. And this is reported in close-up UFO sightings, this quietness. People don't say the UFO was quiet. They say everything was quiet. They say the birds chirping and the crickets, you know, were quiet. The leaves rustling were quiet. There was no traffic noise coming from the road nearby. You know, so they're not describing a silent craft. They're describing a reality. Somehow reality itself is altered. And there's this eerie stillness that's associated with these things. And in an eerie stillness would be an accurate way to describe what I felt. There's a woman, her name is Bridget Barkley. She lives in, she's an experiencer from England. And I had a conversation with her and said, like, well, why would you describe this? And she said, you know, I don't even think I said, how would you describe what we're talking about? You know, she's had some close-up experiences, and she said, you know, you take two magnets and they click together, right? And then you pull them apart and you twist them around so their polarities are opposite. And there's this kind of, you know, you try to push them together and there's kind of this warbling. I'm doing it with my hands right now. You can't see, obviously, but I'm pushing my hands together and they're kind of warbling a little bit and they can't quite click together. And there's this kind of undulating, distorted energy that's between the magnets, right? Mm. You know exactly what I'm saying, right?
Yep.
So she says, being close to the UFO is like being in between those magnets. And when she said that, I was like, oh my gosh, I know you and I have experienced the same thing. That's perfect. Mm. Now I've had that same experience four times total.
Oh, wow.
So in all of those were related to other experiences that were connected to UFOs. One of them was a dream. And then the, so I was quick, you know, at the time in 1993, and that winter, the next morning, I just got up and said, oh God, I had a vivid dream. Like, whoo, never even bothered to go out and look in the snow to see if there's any footprints. Why would I? It was impossible. It couldn't have happened. But I'll tell you the dream. So the dream, which I didn't put in the book, but I've written about it and I did a little drawing of it too. So it's totally a dream. It's a dream. It's not like, don't think it's anything else. So, and I feel like the dream was somehow projected into my psyche, like it was stage managed from some outside source. I feel this very strongly. visiting my brother. My brother says, hey, you know, like I'm doing this government work and I'm not supposed to talk about it and stuff like that. But, you know, like, I got this thing. You'd probably be interested. Let's go in the garage. I want to show you this thing. So we walk in through his house and we walk through the door in his kitchen and go into his garage. And the garage door is down, like the garage is all closed. And there's this little flying saucer like propped up on blocks, on sawhorses, like right next to his car. And I'm like, oh my God, then where did you get this? And it's like, you know, some guy at work had a thing and he couldn't keep it. And so now I have it. You know, I'm like, oh my God, it's a flying saucer. How weird. And he said, yeah, but you can't get close to it or it distorts reality. I'm like, what? So I walked up to it, right? So as I approached it, I got about 5 feet away. I felt that feeling that I felt the exact palpable feeling I tried to describe earlier. I'd back away and it would go away and I'd walk towards it and it would come back. And it was like a message being delivered through my subconscious to my waking self. Cause the next morning I was immediately aware that I know exactly why I had that dream. That dream was to confirm that that event in 93 was real. Mm-hmm. And it was funny in so I go back and forth a few times and then my brother is like, the doors open on the flying saucer and it's dark inside. You can't really see much and it's small. It's not much bigger than a van or something. He's like, yeah, you know, this problem. I can't get close to the thing because the weird distorted thing. But here's what I do. I take this camera and I put it on the end of a big stick and then I put it in the, you know, like he takes a little digital camera and puts it on a long selfie stick kind of thing and then puts it in the door in this dark room and it takes pictures. And that's when I woke up. Mm. Now my brother does not have a UFO a flying saucer in his garage and never did. But that dream had a power to it and it felt like it happened for a reason. Like it was, reassuring mm-hmm. to me, that mm-hmm. dream.
Ah. Yeah, that's a very interesting dream. And you may have ostensibly created the selfie stick.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not gaining any royalties from the selfie stick at this point.
Not yet. Yeah, so. Wow. I have a couple other listener questions here, Mike, if you don't mind, on the fly here. In terms of the grays, one of our listeners was wondering, do you see any connection between the grays and... if they are considered demonic in disguise, as they put it?
Well, I mean, who knows what demonic in disguise means, right?
Very good point.
So someone has a UFO experience in 15th century, Spain, they go to their, Catholic bishop and tell the story. The Catholic bishop is going to say you had a demonic experience and it gets written down in some book and it's described as a demonic experience and someone does painting on a mural and they it shows up as a demon and mm-hmm. It may not have been that at all. It may have been a gray alien, and it may have been misinterpreted as a demonic thing. Now I will also say that people have very dark, frightening experiences, and so calling it demonic might be completely accurate in the sense that it's the emotional visceral reaction is exactly what you would expect from confronting a demon.
Right.
So there's a blurriness there that I can't answer. We're in Google research land now. I mean, you're one click away from so much, flooded with information. If you wanted to write a 400 page book that gray aliens are demonic, you would have no problem filling up a great big book with available accounts.
Right.
So, does that mean it's true? I don't think, I don't know what to think as far as what may be true. Certainly you could make a very forceful argument and collect very credible data and accounts.
Right. I would imagine it's all through the lens that you perceive the experience. You know, if you're a spiritual person, you may see it that way. If you're more of the shamanic, belief system, it may be a sort of, like you said, a totem or a messenger of some sort. It seems to be all about perception.
Yeah, and I had to jump way back because I feel like I try to perceive it from a lot of different angles in the book.
Yes.
And so I had to step out of, one mind frame, which I do. If I do have any mind frame, the shamanic thing was just such a tidy, clean fit.
Right.
And as well as the archetype was a very clean fit for the why of it,
Going back to the owl, Mike, are you aware, one of our listeners wants to know, of any symbolism of the owl in Russia or China in specific? why they chose those, I'm not exactly sure.
But. I'm not sure either. I absolutely have to think there is. I mean, the term shaman comes from a Siberian word. I can't remember the name of the tribe. The Inuits or the native people of Siberia coined the term. I think it was called Samin, and then it somehow got translated to shaman. So I know that the totem animal in that, the Borat tribe, I can't, that's actually not right. The Borats, but that's, what am I saying? That's the dumb movie. So yeah, some tribe in Northern Russia equated the, you know, that they have owl symbolism. I know they do. And it's associated with the shaman. So, and I'm quite certain that China, with a, you know, long history, has all kinds of owl symbology. I don't know what it is, but yeah. I can't answer that one very well. Sorry.
No, not at all. It's a very specific question. I'm interested to look further into that. Did you come across any cases, Mike, where owls were heard but not seen, and an event of high strangeness may have occurred? Do you remember anything in your research of that?
Well, sure. Yeah. So a woman on the beach with her husband, she had a stressful day. They're waiting to get seated at a restaurant, like on the ocean, and they're drinking their margaritas, and the sun is setting, and she hears an owl hooting. It's like, well, I didn't know owls would come to a beach like this. And she looks around, she doesn't see anything. She looks up into the sky, and there's a silvery disc-shaped craft hovering far in the sky above them. She watches it for a little while, and she points it out to her husband, and he says, kind of a doubter. Mm-hmm. She's kind of like, well, what's he going to make of this? And he says, like, well, it's very unusual. It's not making normal motions that would be associated with any known craft. Very interesting. And then she later checks the newspapers, and right in that area over that weekend, which is weird. It's like lasts for a few days. There's a series of sightings, and people are reporting, you know, classic silvery flying saucer, you know, polished aluminum flying saucer in that area. Now, I guess that kind of thing shows up a lot. I mean, people will say that, you know, like I've got people, like one woman contacted me, and she's like, oh God, I was reading your book. And this is like, since the book has come out, so this is in the last couple of months. Like, oh, I was reading your book. And then as soon as I'd lay in bed and I'd open the book, there'd be this hooting out the window. Mm. And I'd close the book and the hooting would stop. And I'd open the book up and the hooting would start again. And then I would close the book and tell my husband, like, oh God, wake up. There's an owl right out the window, and I'm reading this owl book. Isn't that weird? And like, he would wake up, what? And there would be no hooting.
Yeah.
And so the hooting, you know, shows up, you know, a fair amount. Yeah. There's one person, a young guy I talked to, who's had his own set of abduction experience. And he very clearly said, lying in bed, here's an owl hooting out his window. Bam. The next thing he knows, there's his bed is surrounded by gray aliens.
Mm.
They just appear. So, yeah. So, I mean, the hooting is just as vital to the whole thing as seeing them themselves, you know? So,
right. Well, playing off of that, I mean, you looked a lot into the work of Lindy Tucker as well, with the beeping owls and the UFO connection. What can you tell us about that work being done?
Yeah. Okay. So that's kind of a little bit of a long story, but, Lindy Tucker is a researcher. She's Canadian. She now lives in America. But this is back in the 70s. She was having sightings around her house. And at the same time, she was hearing this beeping noise. And she went out and recorded this beeping noise in the presence of this flying craft. So she's got an audio recorder. She's with this other person. This guy's name is Christopher, which shows up a lot in the book. Don't ask me why. People named Chris show up a lot in the book, and which is like Christopher, the first five letters is Christ. So, I mean,
like
if you want a word heavily laden with symbolism, that's it. So she goes out, she does an audio recording of this UFO.
Spoiler.
And you can, I would put a link on your site, go to beepingufos.com. It's amazing. And then there's a little audio clips that she's put a whole bunch of them in a row. It's very interesting. And she has an excellent article that was published in the MUFON Journal in the late 90s. Very important to read that. So she did very straight analytical clinical research on what this may have been. Mm-hmm. This initial recording, I think it was 1976 in Orton, Ontario, has this beeping noise. It sounds like a car backing up, very mechanical. Beep, beep, beep. And overlaid with that is, you can hear crickets in the background. You hear a little rustling from the wind. And you can also very clearly hear a great horned owl. Now, this like blew me away, right? Because I was like so primed. I was like I'm waiting for someone to show a picture. And like there's a, you know, like there's a UFO, a flying saucer above the trees. And in one of the trees, you can see a little owl sitting in a branch. I don't have that picture. I want that picture. I'm like waiting for it. But I do have this audio. I don't have it. But I mean, it's this audio exists where it's an owl overlaid with this odd beeping noise. Now, things get weirder. Okay, so it's not Project Blue Book. I think it's the I'm drawing a blank on that. One of the reports of the government, but the Condon report, that came out in the late 60s.
Right.
They said there's no, you can't listen to anything. But they said we analyzed a bunch of supposed recordings of UFOs, and we've come to the conclusion that it is not a UFO. It is a saw-whet owl. Now, a saw-whet owl, you can go right online and click a little button and listen to the call of a saw-whet owl. It sounds like a car backing up, very mechanical, little tooting noise, beep, beep, beep. You know, you listen to them side by side, just straight, you know, straight ears. You know, you listen to the recordings that Lindy Tucker has presented, and you listen to a saw-whet owl. Saw-whet, they're very similar. Mm-hmm. Saw-whet owl is going to sound a little more flute-like. The recordings of Lindy Tucker sound a little more mechanical. But a researcher, Ronald Stearman, I think is his name, of the University of Texas in Austin back in the 90s, did an exhaustive amount of research on these two noises, and he says they are not the same. The call of the saw-whet owl is not the same of what Lindy Tucker had recorded. And then Lindy Tucker, under very synchronistic circumstances, collected all kinds of these things. Mm-hmm. Like they just kind of arrived in this very strange way, you know. So she was doing research on exactly on the sound of a UFO. The government dismisses this sound as an owl. Okay, so here we have the owl connection. She's got a recording, the very first recording that she did that sent her on this journey that then spawned all these synchronicities and getting more of this stuff. The very first recording she does has an owl overlapping with the UFO sound, this beeping noise. Mm-hmm. Now, she wrote up this report, this excellent report, kind of well worth reading. It's on the site, beepingufos.com. This goes into the MUFON Journal, and they say, hey, the deadline's coming up. They talked to her on the phone like, oh, you got to get this thing. Got to get it in the mail. We got to get here for the deadline. This is back in the 90s, an ancient era where things like you take a piece of paper and put it in an envelope. And so she's like, so her desk is messy. She's searching around. She's got this deadline. It's got this full daylight. The window's open, summertime. She's got the then she sees it, right? Oh, she finds the document. She puts her finger on it. And as soon as she touches it, this beeping noise comes in through the window. Beep, 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 the same noise. When she touches the document that argues that the beeping noise is not a saw-whet owl, but is instead a UFO. This is very strange stuff. This is very strange stuff. This goes well beyond like little scientists in a metal spaceship flying here to you know, conduct some experiments on the hapless humans that live on this planet. Something much richer and much stranger is taking place than that very simple explanation.
Yeah. I mean, therein lay, you know, your entire journey, Mike. I mean, I remember you once saying that you don't mind not finding answers and that you enjoy living in the mystery. What about these mysteries do you find most compelling?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, like you get a mystery novel, right? So it's got a beginning, middle, and end, right? So yeah. There's a reason, like the dime stores are, well, whatever. I'm not sure what's going on now. Like the Kindle, you know, rack or whatever. I mean, it used to be like you'd have the little rack in the drugstore with all the paperbacks, the pulp paperbacks.
And yeah.
Detective novels. And it's a mystery, you know, it's a murder right in the beginning and then they solve the murder by the end. But that's the murder at the beginning is inconsequential. The solving it at the end is inconsequential. It's the journey. It's the story of the detective, which is exciting. There's a reason why, like, you know, I mean, half the television shows in the 70s were detective shows. it's solving a mystery is part of the core human experience, you know, or like actually not even solving. Cause I got to say that like by the, like when you're in the middle of a detective novel, you don't want it to end, a really good one, right?
Yeah.
You know, you read The Long Goodbye by Raymond Chandler. It's like, no, don't end. And it almost doesn't matter who the murderer is, right? You know, mm-hmm. like at the end, it's just going to be the person you least suspect anyway. So, my sense is that, you know, that's hardwired into us, kind of liking the mystery. And I've gotten to the point now where, I mean, I've talked to people feel like, you know, Richard Dolan says this. He's like, you know, I'm going to take a few years out of studying, you know, the historical documents on the Cold War, and I'm going to put some efforts into this UFO thing. I'm going to solve it and then, you know, sort of pat myself on the back and then take on another project. Mm-hmm. He hasn't solved it. I mean, a lot of people say that, you know, like I felt the same way. Like I felt like, oh, like I'll just write up a little essay about UFOs and owls, and then I'll get that out of my system and I'll be done with it. And that's not what happened.
Yeah.
It was a bottomless pit. You know, I pick owls, right? So there's like, as I said earlier, there's a paragraph here and there in any given UFO book, you know, mentions owls somehow or another. And sure, you know, like great, like a little teeny, the tiniest little point on the outlying boundaries of the core UFO phenomena is this owl stuff. But, you know, what digging into it, this, you know, you would think it would just be like a little aside in the literature, but it's just, it's its own beast. It is, it's a bottomless pit. And not only a bottomless pit, it's a bottomless pit of wonderfully engaging, eerie, evocative stories. Hmm. So yeah, I don't have a good answer to what it is, but it has been just so fascinating. I've given up trying to solve it, mm-hmm. and I'm content with the mystery. And yes. So I wish I had a good answer to that. All I can say is that it's been, I don't know. I mean, it's changed my life. It's changed the direction of my life. The question, why owls?
Yeah. Why owls? Exactly. I mean, you have clearly lifted a veil of sorts on a very interesting topic pertaining to the UFO phenomenon as a quote-unquote whole. Like you said, this is a small fraction of
this. Yes, and then it overlaps with other things. You know, the guy who says, like, you know, like I went out in the field and I meditated and I actually asked the world, you know, like, how can I be of service to the world? I need a sign. I want to give back to the world. How can I be of service? And he closes his eyes and meditates in this field and he opens his eyes and there's an owl in the field with him. You know, the woman who's had UFO experiences, you know, goes in the woods and meditates and she says, I need to find my spirit name, you know, and then she opens her eyes and there's an owl like right on the branch right in front of her. Mm-hmm. You know, like the people who have seen, you know, the guy doing death research is cataloged all these strange stories of owls showing up at people's homes after someone has passed. That doesn't have, I mean, some of this stuff doesn't have anything to do with UFOs, but it does have to do with a deeper mystery that's beyond the veil in that realm where the owl would travel, you know, in that alternate form of reality, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's been, so that was the thing that sort of shook me up a little bit about this book was that, you know, like, wow, this is blurs, right? There's not a delineated line and the UFO thing doesn't stop at this one boundary. You step over the fence and then the meditation thing begins. They overlap.
Exactly. Well, I mean, and they continue as well, Mike. I mean, rumor has it you're working on a sequel to the book? Am I correct?
Well, it's a companion to the book, and it's not a rumor; it's a fact. I'm
okay.
Very open about it, so it's not giving away, not divulging anything. So,
good.
So in the context of doing the book, you know, what I found is that there's these stories, right? And it's like, and this is almost like, and I actually used the term the paradox syndrome to describe these, and that sounds a little lofty and I wish I had a better term, but it was kind of like I needed to like say, like, you know, kind of find these stories and there's an example here, and I call it the paradox syndrome, where you get a story and it doesn't make any sense. It's long, it's complicated, it's just page after page after page to write these accounts up, and you go back and forth with the person, and I'm like, well, what else happened? And oh, and this other thing happened, and it just goes on and on and on. And it doesn't make any sense. It loops back on itself. There's no point at the end where it just culminates and someone has an answer. It just is this loopy logic. And it just, you know, a mess of synchronicities and owl stories and UFOs and they were too long to put in the book, right? So there's a couple that I did put in there, you know, that have this quality. And I initially wanted to put all these stories as an appendix, just to have a set of, but it just didn't. It was, you know, wouldn't have worked in a book format. So the easier thing was just make a separate book. So yeah, so the separate book is going to read hopefully like a collection of short stories, and I'll try to keep my speculation to a minimum and just let the stories stand on their own. But so the working title is Stories from the Messengers. It'll have a cover very similar to the messenger, the owl picture on the present book, and hopefully they'll be available side by side. And if you read one, you might be, you know, eager to read the other. So they're just stories that are too long and too complicated. And these long and complicated stories have a sort of proof to me anyway, you know, the weirdness, the irrationality of them. Anne Streber, the wife of Whitley Strieber, had a, like, you know, she said, you know, like, I have a bullshit detector. I've got a BS detector. and if people tell me a story and it's not weird, I don't buy it. You know, if you try to make up a UFO story, it's going to make up something logical, right? And,
yes.
And if, but that's not what people are telling. People are telling illogical stories. So these stories are perfectly illogical. I don't understand why they play out the way they do. But, and then I just wanted to, so yeah, so this follow-up book is hopefully we'll read as a book of short stories.
Great. Where can we find the recent book, Mike?
You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on my website. You can find it on Richard Dolan's website. You can go to your local bookstore and walk up to the counter and say, can you look up a book by Mike Cleland called The Messengers? And they'll find it within a couple keystrokes. So it's out there, and I would prefer everyone go to their local bookstore because they're not going to be around for long. So
absolutely.
Those people have kids, and those kids are hungry. So you got to have
help. Yep. Support your local bookstore for sure.
Yep.
And where can we find your other work, Mike?
There's my blog is hiddenexperience.blogspot.com. I have been mostly using it just promotion, I'm sad to say it, but I've been so wrapped up in these books things to love. So the recent posts are kind of promoting the book. Mm-hmm. But there's all kinds of stuff in there. It's a lot. Now that it's 7 years old, which we figured out, this makes me feel a little weird that I've been doing it this long. 7 years of blogging like this. And then there's a bunch of audio interviews. And there's even an audio reading of one of the chapters of the book that's posted online there. And that would be read by you.
Oh, you. Shameless promotion. Yes. I mean, I've been captivated by your work for years now, Mike, and it was an honor to read just one chapter. I look forward to hopefully reading more. Your work is prolific. It is extremely relevant, and I can't wait to see what you bring to the table next, man. And maybe we'll finally get some of those messages we're all waiting to hear. So I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor.
Somewhere in the Skies is produced by Third Kind Productions in association with Antica Productions and the Antica Podcast Network. To learn more, visit anticaproductions.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.